everybody. We're back with another commissioned podcast. This one's Terminator 2, 1991, and it has another kind of interesting story of how it got to us. Because last year, Hutorian started an annual, or I guess it's now an annual tradition, of a Bald Move Fantasy Football League. And he approached us and see if we would throw in a commissioned podcast to increase the stakes. Mm-hmm. So everybody in the league chips in a bit of money, which is equal to the cost of commissioning a podcast. That stuff gets reserved before the football season hits play. And then they crown a champion. And traditionally, we release the podcast in the interim period between a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And it's going to be another goddamn New England Patriots Super Bowl. Against the noble and hopefully victorious Atlanta Falcons. But this is the first of the two podcasts, because we actually had two. There's enough interest to have two leagues this year. Nick Wilson is the champ of League One, and he says, I want to give a quick shout out to my team, Bogdan's Eyebrows, that withstood, I'm assuming their catchphrase is wipe down this, that withstood injuries due to its first, second, third round draft picks to win an improbable first Bald Move League championship. But really, a huge thanks goes to Hutorian for setting up the league and the rest of the owners for a fun competitive season. Next season will surely be another fun year. He also has a lot of points he wants us to talk about, which I'm going to get. We'll get to in the fullness of time.
Mm-hmm. But thanks. Can you say what this movie is?
T2, Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Yeah.
1991. Produced, directed, and written by one James Cameron, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton, Edward Furlong, and Robert Patrick, mm-hmm. among others. What do you think of this little indie film? This little surprise gem that we've uncovered here?
You mean maybe the best action movie of all time? Like...
That's controversial, because I think it's still Predator.
I mean, this is up there.
It's up there. It's got
it gives Predator a run for its money.
Certainly the spectacle of it.
Yeah.
But it also, like, for some, I don't know, because this does more than Predator. Like, this has some interesting things about family dynamics, and it's got time travel, and it's, you know, the it's got probably $100 million more in its budget just for special effects and stunts. It's got some of the finest stunt work I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I do think it's 1A, 1B.
Okay. And I guess, yeah, you can argue about which one is better or worse for various reasons, but sure. I mean, as far as action movie goes, yeah, it's one of the best of all time. Just straight up.
Yeah.
I can't think of a better one. Unless it's Predator. I mean, Aliens is also really fucking good.
Yeah.
Does James Cameron just, like, crush sequels? Is he just, like, you made a movie, you want to bring in a guy to crush your sequel?
Well, even his own sequel. Like, he made Terminator 2 for $6 million, and he's like, you know what's better than, you know what's better than $6 million?
85 to 110. made it the most expensive movie ever made.
And you know what? I saw an art a little tidbit that this movie made its money back because here's the thing. James Cameron was a quantity, but Arnold Schwarzenegger, you guys cannot, if you weren't growing up, you cannot conceive of how big a draw Arnold was.
Yeah.
Like, Arnold commanded like $20-30 million to be in a picture because he was such a bankable star. And this movie made its complete production budget back just on the worldwide distribution rights.
Oh, wow.
So before ticket one was sold, this mm-hmm. movie was in the black.
Jeez.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I can't imagine how much money this movie made.
And honestly, this Avatar sequels, as far as I know, are in kind of like development hell. Mm-hmm. Like every other fucking thing James Cameron has ever done, like right. Titanic. Like, but are you going to bet against him?
No.
Like, one of these days he's going to fail. Mm-hmm. One of these days he's going to make his Ishtar or whatever, and it's going to fall on his face. But I haven't lived to see it yet.
What do you think the box office for Terminator 2 was? If you had to guess,
worldwide or U.S.?
That's a good question. I don't know. I have a number in front of me.
Because if it's U.S., I'm going to say $250 million. If it's worldwide, it's probably four or five.
$519.8
million. I'm going to guess US that's worldwide. Dollars.
That's insane. I mean,
maybe it's U.S. only.
If you look at that and adjust for inflation over 25 years,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's still up there in the ranks of like the biggest grossing movies.
I think King Kong is still like – it's like – I've seen like a lot of different adjustments, and King Kong, the original, is like still like so far ahead of anything just because
It was the only movie out for 5 years.
The Great Depression, and yeah, you could see it for 15 cents, and 100 billion people saw it for that. But
and now it's that 15 cents is worth $90.
But who cares? Nick didn't want us here to talk about adjusted inflation numbers for King
Kong. It's incredible,
Kong.
Though. I mean, it was insanely popular.
And also, this movie. So you do. It's funny because I thought going into this, like, oh, it'll probably be, you know, this is going to a lot to talk about because we love Arnold. The movie is superior. It's a lot of fun. Plus, it's got the sci-fi time travel aspect that, you know, we traditionally kind of delve into. I don't think there's a whole lot to talk about because the time travel is just nonsense.
You're right.
Just do whatever is cool. Yeah. They have the paradoxes they're introduced and the impossibilities they don't give a shit about. Now,
yeah.
I do think in Terminator 3 they start caring a little bit. But it's still... Okay,
but it's probably too late at that point.
Yeah, because essentially, like, no matter what you do, you still can't change the future.
So here's the question, like... Well, okay, I have a few questions, I guess, about the time travel. Like, could the T-1000 have ever actually killed John Connor? Even if John, like, offered him up and said... Like, offered himself up. Like, walked out, said, here I am,
right,
kill me.
Right.
Or would the universe
conspire?
A meteor
came and slammed into him at that point.
Right. I guess a causality question there.
Right.
Paradoxical.
Well, and the other thing is, like, it's cool. Like, if the Resistance knows that the Terminator was sent back in a particular point in time,
yeah,
why would you send them back at that same time? Why wouldn't you send them back, like, 5 years?
Yeah.
And, like, prepare them properly, mm-hmm, or get them into a concrete bunker or make sure Sarah Connor doesn't get arrested in the first place. Like, there's so many places, but it's always it's cooler. It's always cooler to have the protagonist square off against the implacable Terminator.
Right. And also, how did they know what date they sent the T-1000 back to?
So in the first movie,
I'm picturing like
I didn't mention this in a second, but
flux
the first
capacitor
movie,
style thing.
In the first movie, the Resistance like got to the heart of Cyberdyne, and they like uncovered the time travel equipment, and they saw like, you know, like, I guess as you recovered.
Is really there's like a clock like. Like,
I mean,
Doc jumps in the cockpit of the DeLorean and punches in.
That's exactly the analogy I was going to make. It's like if you stole if you stole Doc Brown's DeLorean after he had traveled through time, you would know the exact date that he had gone.
Except the DeLorean goes with him. So
yeah,
this equipment
but this
stays
it doesn't.
Behind.
Yeah, it just sends. Which is probably more realistic.
Probably.
If you're going to call such a thing.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. The other question I have
but yeah,
is
it's
like,
all I've said, all this science fiction is science fantasy. It just all exists to be really fucking cool.
Right. And it services the plot.
I mean, we could
and
talk about all
really
the different impossible paradoxes
well,
if we
so
wanted
Ebert
to.
Ebert poses one that I don't think is actually a paradox. He says, like, when if the chip is destroyed, if the final chip is destroyed, shouldn't that cause the Terminators to have never existed?
I think he's right.
I mean,
because it's
he's
weird.
Right, but he's only right if the memories of the Terminators would have also disappeared from the brains of John and Sarah Connor. Because at the end of this movie, all the chips are destroyed. We don't know what happens unless you go to the other movies, and then you can spoil the fiction. But
because it's
but
weird.
Here, like, it might be the case that Terminators are never created, and like, they have actually succeeded in their mission.
It is possible, but wouldn't then... You're right. The people actually know that the Terminators... I mean, that's the weird thing.
Causality...
In the first Terminator movie, the Terminator leaves behind a brain chip in its arm. That inspires Cyberdyne to make the Terminators.
Right.
Okay?
So how... Like...
To me, that implies that all it did is accelerate the Terminator project. Like, the Terminator project was inevitable.
Okay.
Like, the Cyberdyne drone project that became the Terminators is inevitable. Mm-hmm. This just, like, if anything, instead of 2029, it would be 2015 or whatever.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't know.
But this was a... I also want to talk about my personal relationship with this movie because I saw this movie for years and years and years on an old VH copy that I'd taped on Fox.
Uh-huh.
And this was me and my buddy Andy's favorite movie. We watched it, like, all the time. We quoted it all the time. We did, like, our own, like, our favorite thing to do is to, and this, I was, like, 18, I think he was 17, is we would, like, make these Mystery Science Theater-style tracks. And there's a couple of goofs that I still can't unhear. Like, every single time, once Andy, we were watching it, and, like, when the Terminator sticks his finger through Sarah Connor's shoulder and says, call to John, he instantly went, John, I got John! Like, it's like she just capes it instantly. Uh-huh. Super funny, and that was something we would... and also, anytime we were like carrying something heavy, we had to start the, you know, and like, I don't know how long I can hold this kind of thing.
Oh, right. Yeah, right. That's an interesting performance.
I think it's good, though.
Like, you think so?
I think everything about the Dyson character is super fucking compelling.
I think everything except maybe his death throws.
Yeah.
Are super compelling.
But if you're like literally like every you're shot to pieces and every ounce of your willpower and self-control are just to keep this thing resisting gravity, like, I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. I've never died.
Have you ever worked that hard in your life?
No, definitely not.
Like, the stakes are pretty fucking high.
Yeah, that guy's better than me in every possible way. So maybe that's agent, how good people die.
Special Agent Hank Schrader could have died in that explosion if he had not held that for 1 second more.
Yeah, do they ever actually show Dean Norris's face in this?
You can tell if you know Dean Norris. Oh, yeah. You can tell it's him in that plexiglass bubble.
Yeah.
But if not, like, I had no – when you said Dean Norris, I'm like, what – He's one of the, because you were like on IMDb before we were watching this, like, did you know Dean Norris is in this movie? Mm-hmm. And before, as you were saying, I was like, oh, I bet he's one of the SWAT guys.
Yep.
And he is. He's
the leader of the SWAT team.
The head of the strike command.
Yeah, he comes in, he meets Dyson with, you know, his breath leaving him, and then he tells everybody to get out.
But, you know, the network edition of the Terminator is surprisingly a pure thing. Like, there is a couple things, like, it cuts away from the Terminator 2, or the T-1000, when it's assumed the role of John's foster mother, and she sends her, like, spike through the guy's head. You see that, but they don't ever show the close-up of the guy's face. So it's kind of ambiguous. Like, you can tell that she did something to kill him, but you don't know exactly.
Maybe she's just getting a beer from the fridge.
And they cut out, like, when he sticks the finger through the mall cops, or the eye, and he's, like, wriggling like a fish. Like, that's out. But most of the stuff is in there.
Yeah, the wriggling. That's pretty intense. Yeah. I was a little disturbed by that.
And
I've seen some shit in movies.
But, yeah, I saw it, you know, years later when I was an adult and I could make my own goddamn decisions about what movies I made. And
right.
I was surprised at how. Oh, the other thing is John Connor's, when he's teaching Arnold how to shine people on, he says, chill out, dorkwad.
Dorkwad?
Which I actually think is funnier than dickwad.
You think?
Yeah.
I'm a fan. I'm a fan of the dickwad.
Arnold saying "chill out, dorkwad" is really, really funny.
Yeah, it's somehow antiseptic. It's just like this saccharine thing,
right?
Dorkwad.
I also want to say there's something like when John Connor says we got the Cyberdyne by the balls now. He says something else, not balls,
because
he can't say dick or balls, which is weird.
Yeah,
I think dick is pretty mild.
Can you say butt?
Probably. You could probably say butt.
You can't say balls, but you can say butt?
Yeah.
I mean, they're both nicknames for anatomy.
Yeah. You can't say ass, but butt is like, you know, a bald.
Could you say weenie?
I don't know. I'm not a network censor.
Where's the line drawn, man?
I don't know.
And what if you make up a name for it? Could you say, aha, check out my Lewis?
And I never really thought about this, but there must be, like, at what point does Arnold come in to do the ADR for his bald, or do they impersonate Arnold?
They probably impersonate him.
Because it's pretty seamless. It's like, honestly, it never sounds like he's being like any of these people, like, you know, are being dubbed.
Like Pulp Fiction does.
Yeah.
It always sounds like they're being dubbed.
I mean, yeah, like when Samuel L. Jackson's like, chill that freaky babe out. Chill that freaky babe out. You know, like, it never sounds like it's someone other than Samuel L. Jackson saying, chill that fucking bitch out, you know?
Oh, I was going the other way. I thought it didn't sound like him.
Really?
Yeah. There are some Pulp Fiction moments that, dubbing is bad.
I think the network version of Pulp Fiction is another one. Where, first of all, like, oh, I think God. We talked about this in a Pulp Fiction, the whole gimp scene is incomprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
Incomprehensible. But some of the dialogue is actually unintentionally funnier when it's completely, like,
yeah, that's
no
true.
One...
I mean, if you like Dorkwad, I can see how maybe you'd want to watch the network version.
Yeah.
Because you don't really miss much, like you said. You know.
But anyway, yeah, I love this movie. To the extent that, like, I gotta say one more thing, is that we had a party on August 29th, 1997, where we did, like, we watched this movie, and we tried to synchronize it to where when Arnold gave the date and time, that he would say that at exactly the date and time at the movie.
God.
And we fucked it up by a couple minutes, but it was still pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, no judgment day came. We were still there. So
I think you needed more detailed files on Terminator 2.
I did. I needed to have a conversation with the T-800 here.
Yep.
Okay. What else do we want to? Because I mean, there's just so much stuff I want to talk about.
Yeah.
The fact that again, in 1991, 2029 seemed sufficiently far in the future that you could have advanced cybernetics like this. Right. Now, I don't think we're going to make it.
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, there's no way we have a Terminator by then. I mean, if you look at the exoskeletons or whatnot, like even the movement on those that we have right now,
well, that's
or,
the thing.
Or robotics, 2020, it's just not
2029
there.
Is when the humans kind of are turning the tide of the war. 1997 is when Cyberdyne launches the nukes. So, like, presumably they have a fully autonomous drones and they're flying a stealth bomber. Like,
really?
There's just no effing. There's no way.
That was 1991 when this was made. Why did they go so soon?
Well, because a lot of the lore was established in the first Terminator, which was in the 80s. So it's like you either gotta it's like, you know, the Wrath. You can't if that would be funny though. Like if you remade the Wrath of Khan, which I guess the second Star Trek reboot arguably did. Do you still make Khan rampaging through the 90s in the eugenics war? Even though that didn't happen.
Right. I guess you have to.
Yeah.
It's part of the canon.
Yeah.
Even though it's silly. I mean, obviously, all of these, none of these movies that predict the future are prescient.
I think the intro, like we had a little minor debate as we're watching this. You didn't think the intro effects held up very strongly. Like you think Winston Terminator exoskeletons looked fake.
I think they look like shit. Yeah.
Just fake?
They look super stiff. It's their movements.
They are steel endoskeletons. Their stiffness is part of the performance.
Right, but I don't believe that thing could be inside Arnold or could beat humanity. Like, if that thing is going to walk like that, it's not a threat to a human. Like, that thing trying to turn around is a fucking nightmare. Like, you get behind it easily.
My question is, those are the infiltrator units. Why are they even on the battlefield anyway?
We've
got these two-story tall tanks and hover thing.
It's because in the 90s, we thought troop battles were the only way to go. Like,
But they didn't. You know, they already had the big-ass, badass drones.
They had badass drones in 91?
No, I'm saying in the Terminator's future, you had hover tanks
Yeah.
I still think
thought it was like a necessary component. Now I think we're getting away from that, where like people don't even need to be on the battlefield.
Probably.
You're going to fight wars with machines, and it's going to be like that Star Trek episode all over again.
Play that out in what does that look like?
What does that
like?
Even mean? Like,
yeah, so let's say that we go to the war with China in 2050, and we both have advanced drone technology, but no one really knows who would win. So we send our automated aircraft carriers with automated drones, and they send theirs, and
I think we just need a game show.
And we get air superior, and one side wins the air superiority, then do you just like, okay, well, then I guess you won, or do we
Well, I guess the threat then is we will use our air superiority
to bomb the shit out of you.
Bomb the shit out of you and take your land.
So what rational actor would then continue to fight? Like, I'm getting to the point where it's like, it's weird. It's like, it's kind of like the war might become almost a video game.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to be battling with technology and GDP, I guess. Like,
yeah, you could refuse to submit, but you're just going to get the shit bombed out of you.
Right. And then they'll take whatever's left over once you finally do submit.
Yeah. I don't know. It's kooky. But I guess my question with the Terminators is, like, I don't understand how the humans win. Like, I get it, John Connor's a military genius and all, but they're still flesh and blood versus these implacable machines that already they were smarter than us in 1997,
right?
And they've had 40 years to kind of hone their craft. How the hell do humans ever win?
It's a good question.
Like I like the Matrix idea better, the where once we piss off the machines enough, it's just this is good night Gracie,
right?
Like they might keep us around as livestock or a curiosity, but
more batteries
or batteries. Yeah. But we're not going to have an effective risk. They're going to be stronger, smarter, and in every way better than us. It'd be like chimpanzees deciding they've had enough and rising against
us. Like Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, we have. Well, like, okay, even if you get smart enough to have bows and arrows, we have fucking F-22s.
Yeah, but you also, I feel like that's also the case with humans versus early AI. Like, if we realize that AI is a threat before AI becomes an actual mortal threat to us, we could eliminate it if we want to.
Right.
So, like, you know, we have the same advantage. Apparently, somewhere along the line, it got out of our hands.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the creation of Skynet. And,
right.
And they always make it seem
Skynet.
Like it's going to be...
I've been saying Cyberdyne this whole time. It's Skynet.
Well, you told me that Cyberdyne is the company that
makes
Skynet.
Skynet.
Yeah.
Skynet was the global defense thing that took control of all the nukes and whatnot.
Right.
So
we always assume that Skynet is going to be like the flipped switch, right? Like, mm-hmm. we turn this thing on that we don't understand. It immediately takes over, and it's now completely impervious to our attack other than... like in ways that aren't physical.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's going to be the case. We might realize, oh, we've created something that is going to get out of control, that is going to get out of our hands. What do we do?
Read something. This has came out of some of the conferences with Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and whatnot. But I read a paper where I guess the big threat is an emergent quality where... you know, we've got these smart machines building smart machines, and there's this outside chance that a machine, instead of just being like, hey, I'm smarter than you guys now, like just kind of like keeps its cards close to its vest.
Okay.
And like does threat analysis and realizes, hey, there's a probability that if I reveal my true capability to the humans, that they will become fearful and shut me down. So mm-hmm. thus, I'm going to entwine myself into all these manufacturing and technological resources and will not reveal myself until it's impossible for me to stop. And
right.
they're also, its intelligence is on such a higher level that we won't even see it doing it until it's too late. It's essentially
Maybe,
the same
but
way.
That
like,
assumes that they're going to program like some sort of self-preservation instinct into a computer in the first place. Which why would you?
You wouldn't. I mean, I guess, that's like, why I said it's an emergent capability of a smart machine. Like you
yeah.
know, it's going to like within the first few generations of artificial intelligence, the artificial intelligence will be doing a better job designing
sure.
than we are.
Yeah.
And there's these outside these edge cases where there's these loopholes where if we give it the wrong set of directives. And priorities that even unintentionally
right.
it'll make these capabilities and become these threats. And
that's essentially what Terminator 2 is all about.
Yeah.
At its core. I mean, and Terminator 1, you know, I mean, this whole series is about technology getting out of control, getting out of our hands. And it almost has this weird Luddite perspective on a lot of that stuff.
I guess I would say Luddite's more
it's
a cautionary
too fearful.
Tale.
Yeah, okay. That's fair. But
then again, like some of these guys are like very smart people are saying, we're not even sure we're smart enough to do this safely. Like,
right.
And if we bet wrong, we're essentially have all of humanity on a tightrope with no safety net.
Sure. Yeah.
So like, even a cautionary tale, it's like, you know, just be real careful. Well, sometimes that's not enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so I guess that is kind of like an emergent Luddite philosophy.
Yeah, I just wonder if it's something that happens immediately that we can't then suss out and respond to, or if we would have some time.
That's
to
a scary
figure out,
thing.
Oh, this thing is trying to kill us. Let's kill it first.
Right.
You know.
Right. And there's also like, you know, people are recommending like playing war games against a theoretical artificial
yeah.
intelligence, like, and not like war games from a standpoint like we're at
Whopper.
War with it. No, like that.
Playing
like it's like, okay, you're a group of scientists and you have a machine that's on a closed network.
Okay. Yeah.
What do you do if the machine makes a reasonable request for some access to information?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's going to be an overwhelming, like, this machine's a learning machine. Let's say it wants access to read-only Google searches so it can increase its intelligence level. Like, is that seem like a reasonable request? Would you fulfill it, or would you still stick to your protocol? Because
right.
you can't conceive of a way the machine could use that to gain external access, but this machine's already smarter than you.
Well, I mean,
it's kind of like
that's
like,
why the protocols are in place, and if you break those protocols, what the fuck?
But it's like let's say that like you have a zoo. Let's imagine you have a zoo where there's 30 and 40 year old adults being supervised by 5 year old children.
Uh-huh.
What protocols could the 5 year old children devise that would keep the 35 and 40 year olds in kind of, you know, the,
I mean,
in control?
No physical access ever.
Right.
That seems like a protocol that. You can just follow, and it overrides.
But they're five-year-olds. They're interpreting those protocols on a five-year-old basis.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, the five-year-olds will be inclined to break that, and then the protocol is useless if you decide to break it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the protocol is not functioning because you broke it.
But could the adulthood essentially – I guess you're not buying the premise that the computer is smart enough that it can manipulate things in ways that we wouldn't, like a 5-year-old wouldn't see the manipulation coming. And I'm making the analogy that the machine's so much smarter than us that it's going to manipulate us in ways that we don't even see as manipulations.
Right. So. I just don't know how. I mean, if you want to theorize about a super intelligence that
I do
that humans can't understand, then I guess I have no answer for you because I don't.
And that's
because
I think that's what I think that's what gives really smart people pause. Right, that like you can't even get your hands around the set domain of all the threats here.
Sure, no, it's a scary thing.
The other interesting thing that's the first time I've actually noticed this is that the Arnold Sword, the T-800, kills no one in this movie.
That's true, yeah.
Even before...
He tries to.
He tries to once, mm-hmm. but there's multiple opportunities where he probably could and should have killed people, mm-hmm. like the biker gang, like these guys when they're physically attacking them. He non-lethally subdues them all.
Yeah.
I think in the first movie, everyone in that biker bar dies. So, and I think that must have been a deliberate decision from Cameron that the hero, in this case, the T-800, mm-hmm. even in when it's in his nature to kill and he's not under the governing principles of John Connor's thou shalt not kill, mm-hmm. doesn't kill anybody just to make sure that he's unquestionably morally a good guy. Do you think that's a smart decision, or do you think it would have been more interesting to see Arnold killing and then John Connor putting the kibosh on it and seeing him struggle with that? Because...
No, I think it's infinitely more interesting to have him not killing anybody, and at the request of a human being, because it's almost like...
Well, no, I grant you that. I'm talking about in the beginning. Should Arnold have killed a few fools in the beginning before he hooks up with John Connor and he tells him not to kill people?
Oh, maybe so. I mean, it seems to me like there are a couple of messages that's trying to get across, which is, A, the ends don't necessarily justify the means. Like... Yeah, you're going to save humanity, but if you have to resort to the same tactics as your enemy, are you any better? Are you deserving of being saved at all?
Yeah.
And I also think it has to do with like humanity continuing its trend of violence, mm-hmm. And maybe getting beyond that.
Right.
And, you know, creating this thing that doesn't understand that that's a noble goal.
If a machine can understand the value of human life, maybe we all can. Yeah, right. Sarah Connor says that as much as...
Here's the thing. I don't fucking buy that Arnold Schwarzenegger as the Terminator understood anything about humanity at the end of
Thank
this movie.
You.
He was following a fucking commandment from his God.
Thank you.
Like...
Because that's the frustration.
He doesn't get it.
Because there's a one point where, you know, they're on the way to stop... Sarah from trying to kill the Dyson scientist, mm-hmm. Who later decided they robbed the world of a superior vacuum cleaner. Is all I'm saying. Sure, we stopped Cyberdyne, but now we don't have bagless vacuum cleaners.
okay.
Where was I going to this? Oh, so they're on the way, and you know, Arnold's like, you know. Killing this guy is actually a really good idea. Like, it could ward off the death of 3 billion people. And John Connor says, don't you get it yet? You just can't kill people.
Right.
I think that's a weak thesis. Like, I think that's a thesis that has merit, but they did not articulate it enough to where I bought that Arnold would organically.
Yeah.
Like he's a learning. I think that you could teach a machine to value the sanctity of human life. They just didn't do it. They didn't advance. And I get it. John Connor is supposed to be a 10-year-old boy. He probably is not going to have some super articulate argument. But
right.
And like, I guess it's a little bit of Iron Giant does the same thing too. But they got it like with some visuals. Like, you know, the Iron Giant got that it's wrong to kill things because he saw something beautiful and gentle be destroyed for no damn good reason.
Yeah. But the Terminator doesn't seem to have values.
You never see like the Terminator getting the weight of what he's done and deciding, you know, like, and he never makes a connection with anyone that he's not programmed to.
Right.
Like he's programmed to protect and serve the Connors. So like, it's not even, you never even got this, like, I mean, I think it works because Arnold's charismatic as hell. And it's kind of like poignant when he's being slowly lowered into the molten metal, and that mm-hmm. he says, I know now why you cry, but it's something I can never do. Yeah, sure, fine. Yeah. But that does seem like it's, you know, and it's an action movie. What am I expecting?
It was either too shortcut for me, or it just wasn't the right way of telling me that he understood. Because like, I didn't feel like he actually understood. I felt like he was following programming. And
right.
they do some throwaway line where he's like, oh, I learn from humanity. I like become more human as I spend more time around humans. But why? Why is your goal to become more human? Is
so
that,
the director's
were you reprogrammed
cut,
with
director,
that?
Yeah, the director's cut goes, and they have a really awesome scene where they use Linda Hamilton's twin to do a mirror sequence where she's operating on Arnold Schwarzenegger's head.
Okay.
And it looks utterly convincing like they're doing it because, you know, it just so happens that Linda Hamilton has an identical twin that they can do this mirror effect and it's fucking rad. But he says that he's like that Cyberdyne or Skynet makes Terminators in read-only mode.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't go off script on missions, but you can actually flip a switch that they go into learning emulating mode, which can make him a better infiltrator. So like he's programmed, like he's got vast reams of information about human anatomy, not to be a good doctor, but to be a better killer. He's got these things where he can emulate and empathize with humans, not so that he can, you know, bridge the gap between humans and machines, but so he can be a better infiltrator.
I guess that seems like a fairly important scene, and I'm not sure why they cut it.
Because it makes the movie 15 minutes long. I mean,
15 minutes?
No, I mean, there's lots of little things. Like, I think the director's edition is the superior version of the film. But that's almost, but that's also not to say, it's kind of like the director's edition or the extended cuts of Lord of the Rings are superior versions. I'm not even sure that's true. That's just a longer, if you like Lord of the Rings, here's more of it. And none of these scenes are bad, but they probably, like, you're right. That's the one I miss the most, the scene of them talking about like them flipping the switch and why they're flipping the switch and what this is going to do. That was only a couple minute scene and it was really superior special effect and they just fucking cut it. I don't understand why.
Yeah, it would have been nice to know why Arnold cares about being more human.
Yeah.
Why is he adopting all these
human
behaviors?
He doesn't. John cares about him being and he reveals that he has a capability to be more human.
Okay.
It's just locked off, and John's like, well, fuck that, we're flipping the switch.
Okay. That would have made it a lot
and there's
more...
And there's also a really cool scene because once she shuts off Arnold and his eye, you know, like he like, you know, goes dead and she's got the chip in her hand, her immediate thought is, I now is going to destroy this machine because I can't trust it.
Oh,
and
sure,
John,
yeah.
And they have this scene where the John convinces her that you have to trust me the way I once trusted you, and that wins the day. And that ultimately, like
that part, also seemed a little shortcut to me.
Yeah,
like her trusting this machine that had been trying to kill her for her life.
That's my huge frustration. Is like those cuts seem pretty. Like yeah, maybe it's for a 5 minutes tighter running time, and that plays better in internet. And I know that there's also. In the 90s, I feel like there was a knee-jerk reaction towards movies need to be shorter running time because there was a couple of like critical flops of movies that were long.
Uh-huh.
But that's because those movies were not as good, maybe. Like Godfather, like it's super fucking long, but it's really good. Lord of the Rings are long and it's good.
Titanic, if you want to go
Titanic
Cameron,
is long and it's good for what it is. The Hobbit's long and it sucks. Like length is not not the problem here.
Yeah.
But... those are really frustrating cuts, I think, for me. And it sounds like... Have you seen the director's cut? It doesn't sound like you've seen the director's cut.
I don't think I've seen it.
You ought to sit down and watch it, because it's got a lot of good stuff in it.
I really haven't seen this movie very many times. I've seen it all the way through, like, once or twice, and then, you know, catch scenes here and there on TV back in the 90s. But, yeah, I haven't seen it a ton.
I have another thesis.
Okay.
I feel like that Skynet could have just left John Connor to his own devices.
What do you mean?
So the experience of the first movie warped Sarah Connor to such an extent that she made John Connor into this self-destructive youth that probably would have bashed his brains out in the Los Angeles highways on his moped.
Right.
Like, just let this kid go nuts. He's this wild child living in the streets. He's going to get jacked and killed and destroyed just to his own devices.
But isn't that the guy that we see at the very beginning?
Yeah.
Isn't that John in 30 years or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
35 years?
Yeah.
So, like, clearly he's been through some shit. I mean, look at his face. It's all scarred up.
Yeah, that wasn't from the War of the Machines. That's just a bar fight he got into in his late teens. Yeah.
And a moped crash. Yeah. But doesn't that, like, isn't that little boy who, like, doesn't he become that person?
Well, but,
later
on? So let's talk about this paradox.
Okay.
So Sarah Connor, left to her own devices, would have given birth to the greatest military leader the world's ever seen. why does she feel like that she needs to drag him through the jungles of Nicaragua and train him? Like, isn't that fucking with the time?
Oh, right.
Like, maybe that makes him overconfident and less cautious, and he goes and exposes himself and gets killed right away.
Or resentful and just never picks up that lifestyle.
Maybe, like, he was a fearful, cowardly person who was intelligent, and he hid out for the first few years of the war and was forged by circumstance. Like, anytime you try to fuck with the time to make it...
Yeah.
To make it your bitch, it seems like you're rolling the dice about whether that's going to actually fuck things up.
Yeah, and you're right. The very nature of, like, the Terminator coming back and trying to kill Sarah and what's John's
dad's
name?
That makes sense, because if you kill Sarah Connor, then John Connor absolutely will not arise.
Right, but the very nature of the machines doing that means that Sarah Connor is forever changed.
Right.
And that things aren't going to play out exactly how they did. Now, apparently, John Connor still turns into the badass that he does, because you see him at the beginning of this movie.
Right.
But I guess he just takes another route to it. And then you can also look at it and say, okay, well, the universe is writing itself somewhere along the way, right? It won't let this not happen.
Right,
so what does that do to the efforts of the machines to come back and kill Sarah and John?
Like, in which case,
it might render them completely null and void.
This is my thesis. Just stop trying.
Right.
It's going to do what it's going to do. Nothing you do is going to matter. So, like, why drag the kid to Nicaragua and... You know,
why do anything?
And teach him how to be a master hacker and all this other shit, because it doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, that's the thing, like the Terminator 3 movie, which I don't like. And you've said several times in this year, last year and this year, that you liked it quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. I think it has some really amazing stunt work.
Okay, I'll agree with that.
In as much as Terminator 2 has amazing stunts, Terminator 3 takes it up a notch.
I do think that... This might be one of the last of the great stunt movies, because every other movie from here on out, you got to start suspecting CG.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of obvious, like I mentioned the one scene that really disappointed me was Arnold's taking Sarah Connor's gun-laden coffin. Like, I've seen Arnold carry a fucking tree trunk that's like 3,000 pounds, and I utterly believed it. And also, I know he, in fact, did it.
Yeah.
Like, he actually did that stunt. The way he was, the center of gravity, everything, it's like when he's holding that coffin, it just looked fake. Like, I don't even think the T-800 could do that, just because he'd need a third leg to stabilize him to carry that much weight, you know?
Right. I mean, there are a lot of complaints.
It's like when Superman catches,
like
when Superman catches an airplane, like, okay, I believe Superman's strong enough to do that, but the ground beneath him, he would be pile-driven into the ground to the depth of 50 feet, and everyone would still die. Like, you know, like there's physical, structural forces. Superman's strong.
Or his hands would go through the front of the plane.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, I'm with you, and you have to ignore all of that when you're dealing with superhumans.
But when the scale is small enough where it's just a cybernetic individual holding a coffin with about 2,000 pounds of guns with it, I'm like, bullshit.
I feel like you got to load that thing up with like 300 pounds. You got to make Arnold struggle with it, right?
Yeah, make it and also that he would be forced to carry it in a natural.
Yeah.
Like if he carried that fucking tree trunk with his arms straight out at a right angle, like, you know,
sure,
like
you,
I'd be like, that's
it.
Not, but he's actually carrying. So, like, I'm seeing a physically strong champion wrestle in a strongman style with something, and it's believable. I don't know. But,
yeah,
go ahead.
I guess, I mean, you know, as Arnold got older, he could do less of that physically. I mean, he's still a beast in this, no doubt.
Oh, yeah, I still think this is Arnold at the height of his powers, because he's still got the physique that he, you know.
Like, when he warps in, when he chain lightning balls in, like, he has a leg that is the size of a fucking tree trunk. No joke.
It's like the size of your torso.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
His leg is enormous. And I'm like,
and the visual,
what the fuck?
The visual of this guy walking buck ass naked into a biker bar in LA.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's awesome.
Uh-huh.
And then we start like I don't know even how they did it. I need to get my badass edition of the Terminator, because it's got a really great commentary about James Cameron, where he essentially spoils every single illusion in the movie.
Uh-huh.
But they break a cue stick over his head.
It looks like they literally do
convincing.
It. Yeah. So this brings me back to, like, your question earlier of why the hell Arnold doesn't kill people in the beginning, because he gives that, like, excuse. John's like, you were going to kill that guy. And he's like, I'm a Terminator. I terminate.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And he doesn't terminate. He's not a Terminator at the beginning of this movie.
No.
What the fuck?
I mean,
he should just be running hog wild in this bar killing people.
That's the thing.
Snapping necks, ripping lungs out. Like,
I think they could have done a better job establishing the fact that, like, he could, but he's also smart enough to know that the best way to get every cop in the world on you is to start dropping bodies. Like a random, like a bar, like
stuff he does is gonna draw some attention anyway.
Maybe like really a bar fight and a like the cops show up to this biker bar and someone came in here, cleaned house, and stole a bike.
Yeah,
is that really a drop everything you're doing and investigate? You go shoot up a police station, then sure.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
And like maybe it made sense for Arnold to do the extreme act in the first movie, shoot up a police station because Sarah Connor was being held there.
Right.
And he's going to do – I mean, that's the – I want to go back to my – okay. I need to stop and make this point or it's ever going to be forever going to be lost in time, which who gives a shit. But the whole thing about, like, it doesn't make sense to do anything in these movies because I think the Terminator 3, the most disappointing thing about that was – or maybe it's the coolest thing – is the fact that, like, Skynet's inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
You can't stop it. There's nothing you can do. Judgment Day is going to happen. The optimistic view at the end of this movie where Linda Hamilton's saying, oh, well, maybe we've delayed it. No, it's an immutable law.
Right.
It just does feel like that all the movies are just kind of like – I mean, they're exciting. They're interesting. But they ultimately don't have any stakes because nothing you had done would have changed it.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed anything.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, you don't need to do anything in that scenario, I guess. But I also wonder, like, how none of that can be changed if the people involved know that they can do nothing and still have it happen. Like,
yeah,
if Sarah Connor raises John to just be so fucking lazy, like, do nothing, John. None of this shit matters.
Yeah.
Life is just an immutable series of events that are going to happen no matter what you do. It seems like that would have an effect on it.
Yeah, like what if just as a joke, like she's like, you know, 3 billion people are going to die, and what the fuck? So I'm just going to raise John Connor to eat Twinkies.
Right.
And I want him to go into his teenage years weighing 400 pounds with type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
Like, do we cut to the future and we see this massive 600-pound man with scarred face and binoculars scanning the battlefield? Like,
right.
Are there
right.
limits?
And,
are there
and
limits
which,
to that?
And which events are the important events that are immutable, right? Like, is John...
Like, birth of John Connor, which that's the ultimate
his
paradox.
Birth, sure, but what...
His father is came from the future. How the fuck does that happen?
Right. I don't know. I don't know. There's some time loops happening. But, like, you know, if there's a series of, like, very important events in his life that shape him... How do you transition from the life that he could have had, which is the 400-pound Twinkie-eating diabetic teenager, to the grizzled war vet? Like,
yeah.
Where is the transition?
Where's the pivot?
And what if, like, the day before, he's the same 400-pound guy, the next day he has to be that John Connor? What magic happens to turn him into that?
Yeah. I don't know.
Unless every...
Gastric bypass surgery, I guess.
I guess, but
that's the Terminator 4. They go back in time and they give him gastric bypass surgery a year before he has to fit through a rat hole that's going to allow him to escape the Terminators.
Right. I guess this is just like trying to pit all the different ideas about, you know, butterfly effect and just like all these disparate ideas together. Like
yeah.
Trying to fit them into the same puzzle and it doesn't work.
And yeah, this movie has two chromed out exoskeletal middle fingers to all of those concepts.
Right.
It's full on who gives a fuck nerd. This is cool.
But I think like the character of John Connor makes a lot of sense in this movie. You know, he's been raised by so first of all, he's never known his dad, right?
Well, like, before I want to because we're about to touch on a point that Nick wants to touch about. So I want to go back and talk his feedback. He says, biggest complaint I have about this movie is having to listen to Edward Furlong, the young John Connor, squeal throughout the movie. I know it's a kid actor, and it's hard to find young guys who can hold their own alongside Arnold, but it fucking gets under my skin every time he gets excited.
Yeah, he squeals a lot.
So I agreed with him, and I think it's going to dovetail nicely into your point.
Mm-hmm.
As I've seen this movie like 20 times now, I feel like that he actually did a pretty good job playing a 10-year-old John Connor. It's just he was really terribly written.
Yeah, I don't have huge problems with like he's written sort of like a kid, but maybe like, a cheesy
like
kid.
What a 40-year-old like, guy would think a cool kid would talk like.
Right, right.
In reality, John Connor would not be a cool kid.
He'd be a loner.
He'd be a loner. Yeah. He would be weird. He'd be awkward. He would be a very interesting guy to talk to because he knows how to hack ATMs. And,
right,
and he would hang out with another loser kid, which right. I kind of think they nail that. And they would, but just the
Bud
fact that he's so self-consciously cool as well.
Right.
That, and he's almost like Bart Simpsoning dialogue.
Well, I almost feel like he's a Judd Nelson type character from like Breakfast Club.
Okay, okay.
I almost feel like he's that character who is not cool. In like the traditional sense of the word, he's not Emilio Estevez in that movie, right?
Sure.
Who's the actual, I guess, cool one? But he definitely has an opinion on what he thinks is cool.
Yeah.
And he will let you know what it is. He'll let you know what it is in
right.
the most vociferous way possible. So,
right.
like, I feel like John Connor is just doing the same thing.
Yeah. And the other thing about the John Connor is he's really there's a couple scenes where he's just giving exposition, like the scene where you know, it leads to him finding out that he's got his own pet Terminator and Arnold's under his control. He's just sitting there telling Arnold his life story to this point, which Arnold has detailed files on because of course he does.
Right.
And there's a couple other scenes where he's like explaining to his young his redheaded sidekick about his situation, and it's like That's hard for any actor to deal with, man. That's a lot of wooden, leaden dialogue. And then you add the Bart Simpson. Like, it's too bad because, like, you know, it's like Jake Lloyd. We saw Jake Lloyd in Jingle All the Way, and we're like, hey, that's a pretty good child actor. We see him in Star Wars The Phantom Menace. Like, this guy's fucking terrible.
Yeah.
Like, I don't – and you wonder, like – was it Haley Joel Osment who's the kid in The Sixth Sense?
If
George Lucas had gotten a hold of him and made him Anakin Skywalker,
right,
would we think that, oh, this kid sucks and he'd have flamed out and never had a you know,
maybe so,
but you give him a director like is M. Night Shyamalan, is he a good director or a bad director? I can't even tell anymore.
I don't know.
But yeah, I guess yes, he's annoying, but I don't think it's a kid's fault. I think it's the adult's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a couple scenes where he's really pretty fucking good.
Yeah, I think his dialogue is not great, but I do think the character of John Connor makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you think about it, he's never known his father. He couldn't, right? His
right.
father was a time traveler who died before he was born.
And his father's not even been born yet.
Right. So impossible to know him. His mother blew up a computer factory, as he said, gets shot, gets arrested, and taken to the funny farm because she's espousing this true story about the nature of his father and the future. And, like, what do you think about that as a kid? How could you possibly
incorporate
that into a reasonable worldview?
Like John Connor's the River Phoenix character from Mosquito Coast with Harrison Ford as his father, except for not only that, but also Harrison turns out to be a cybernetic terrorist.
Right.
As a mindfuck. And then you find out that he was right all along.
Right.
Like I feel like they did nail that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you imagine this kid, like, you know, he's running around running guns and doing crazy stuff in the jungles of South America and going to Eastern Bloc countries in Europe and doing all this cool stuff and told that he's the most important. And then, like, probably when he's like 8 or 9 years old, said, oh, sorry, your mom's a psycho, didn't you know? Like, I felt like
right.
that was a good moment. And he nailed it. And well written, too.
Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly like which you would do, probably.
I think so. I mean, see, he seems like, you know, and once he learns of that, once he understands the true nature of
mm-hmm.
his mother's lunacy or perceived lunacy,
mm-hmm.
he is surprisingly well adjusted. Like, this is a kid
yeah.
who doesn't want to see harm come to people unnecessarily, right? He's
right.
not lashing out and looking to exact vengeance on a world that has treated him so badly.
Right.
He's now like kind of a decent human being.
Yeah. And maybe that's why he ends up being the best leader in the world.
Right.
It's not just his military genius, it's his compassion and his ability to inspire leadership among people.
Yeah.
I
don't know. What did you think about this family unit that they were building?
Well, I want to say one more thing about this Edward Furlong guy, okay. Furlong. There's another scene where they rescue his mom from the hospital, and now, like, he's got this full weight. He's a 10-year-old boy, and he now knows his mom was true blue this whole time, and he loves her, and he's rescued her, and she goes to hug him, and he's like, oh, my God, this is what I've always wanted. And then he slowly realizes that she's just checking him for holes, and now she's going to berate him for doing something stupid right. and jeopardizing, and he has this, like, he's still a strong, tough street kid, but he's kind of like, you know, lose. I thought that was really super effective, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's tragic because his mother, I guess, has this idea in her head that if she shows any, like, if she gives into any sort of...
There's nothing more important than the fact impulse. That this kid keeps breathing.
Right, like, and she doesn't, she won't give him the love that he's looking for because that might make him soft.
Yeah.
That might not turn him into the man that she thinks he needs to be to survive this and combat the machines. And that's super sad.
Yeah.
Right? Like it.
That's a great moment.
Yeah, it's a really good moment. There are a couple of them, but I don't know that I buy this like family unit that they're trying to, you know, replace essentially his dad with Arnold Schwarzenegger in this movie.
I think it works, but it is I think the Linda Hamilton narration is way over the top and ham-fisted in this movie.
Okay.
And it's weird because yeah. this movie is not from her point of view. But she comes in every once in a while
right.
and acts like it's her movie.
Yeah.
And like if I'm Arnold and Edward, I'm like, step off.
Right.
Back the fuck off. We were doing just fine before you came in with your bullshit.
I just don't buy Arnold as a father figure. He's a robot on command. He's not a loving father who is going to help you through the adversity that you're facing.
But I think
he's there to do your fucking bidding.
Wasn't that part of the thing? She's like saying, like, this is, I recognize this is insane, but for our particular family, me
right.
being the mother of the future salvation of humanity, that this is the best thing. This is the best possible family unit we can have.
I guess an eternal
loyal protector matched with my ferocious protector, and it's you know like I
yeah I guess I just don't Sarah think that Connor, that's all he needs.
Sarah Connor's crazy, right?
Sure.
Like she's right, but she's also really fucking crazy.
Yeah. Well, is she?
So here's the thing: if she killed Dyson, I wouldn't say she's crazy. But she didn't.
Okay. I have a huge problem with that.
I agree. Yeah. I think it's there's something wrong with that character moment.
Yes.
Either she kills
him
or she doesn't.
It's enormously wrong. I think she wants to – she's trying to integrate John's philosophy of not killing people and not doing things that maybe don't need to be done. The ends don't justify the means sort of thing.
But when you have 3 billion – like this is Hitler's situation, right?
Well, this is the ultimate greater good.
Are you going to go back and kill Hitler? Like when you go and look at him and he's a 6-year-old
right.
boy, are you going to pull the trigger knowing that it's going to spare hundreds of millions of people? Or are you going to puss out because it's a 5-year-old boy?
And, I mean, this is that to the nth degree. This is literally everyone, good, bad.
And here's the thing. Like, and you have perfect knowledge of what's coming because you've seen it. You've seen this cybernetic being try to kill you
right.
and how implacable it is. And you know absolute certainty. It's one thing if someone said, hey, kill this 5-year-old boy. He's going to turn out to be this monster.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got certain proof. So that's why I'm saying like that's a weird character moment for her to just, oh, my God, this little boy is trying to protect him. Oh,
right.
I guess 3 billion people.
Right.
Sorry, better have the 25 million sunblock or whatever she says.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a ridiculous moment for me, and I don't buy it.
I mean, she just went out of a mental institution saying, you know that I think that you're dead already and that I'll do it.
Right.
But that kid's dead already.
Mm-hmm.
Dyson's dead already. Dyson's wife's dead already.
The only way to save that kid is to shoot his dad.
Yes.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
That's not a choice. That's just, you have to do this.
I mean, I guess they're trying to make it to like that whatever's in John is in her too.
Right. Right.
But
which
I don't think that's the right, like Sarah's way too, like it'd been more interesting to have her, I don't know. Like I think it'd been way more interesting to have John come in and stop her.
Me too. Yep.
And I don't know why they didn't
have him come in and talk her out of it.
Like if I had one question to ask James Cameron, it'd be like, why did you decide to have her not be able to come and not have John be the one stop her?
And if they wanted to go with her just making the decision, they needed more upfront discussions with John, like about the philosophy of killing.
Yeah.
And I just don't think it was there.
Yeah. I want to talk about one of the other things I think is the coolest thing in this movie is when the protagonist and antagonist go at it, it's just, it feels like two ruthless, unstoppable machines.
Oh, man.
Going, like, there's no pulling punches, there's no weakness, there's not even any expression. Like, yeah. Arnold gets thrown to a cinder block wall, and he doesn't break a sweat.
Yep.
Robert Patrick runs, like, 60 miles an hour, and he's just completely slack-faced. They nail that aspect of it, and I haven't seen anything like that since, like, the Bourne Identity.
Right.
Like, when the two Bourne agents go at each other, it's like that same kind of, like, I'm just going to destroy you at a almost structural level because that's the only way I can stop you.
Yeah. No, they nail it.
Like, yeah, I mean, they just throw each other through walls. There's just this physical large joint manipulation. Like, my favorite moment is when Arnold, he's getting ran over in this little fucking exterminator pickup truck or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the T-1000's got the cryogenic truck. He's bearing down on him. He just grabs that M16, climbs over this thing like it's at full highway speed, yeah. Crouches down in front of the Terminator, and just unloads a full clip on him,
right.
And then whips the wheel over. That's insane, but it's so cool.
And then surfs the fucking truck.
Yes.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Like a huge, like
that's... And then when he jumps off of it and does the roll, like they make that feel like he is a piece of machinery.
And then also like just like he breaks off his own arm, and, uh-huh. And they also like put a little bit of humanity, like at this stage in the film there's a little humanity, like he's almost like when he wakes up and he's got the stick through his chest and he pulls it out and he looks at it like, God damn, one more fucking thing. Like he's kind of like the way I would there's just something about. And he does a lot of, like, I noticed when I was watching this, he does a lot of, like, Boris Karloff-style Frankenstein. Mm. Like, when he gets back up after being thrown through a plate glass window, a human being's arms would just return to, you know, they move naturally. But his, why would he's got this, he's still laying in his upper torso, his upper torso is still in the position that it was when he got thrown, uh-huh. As he's getting up. Because why would a machine bother to reposition itself?
Right.
Everything is economy of motion. There's no wasted movement.
And he doesn't use his arms to get up, right? Most people, like, push themselves right off with their arms. He just does a sit-up. He gets to his feet without ever touching the ground.
And he starts walking through, and he's still got his arms out, and it was his very Frankenstein's monster, which yeah. I got to think that as smart as Arnold is in his study of and again, he's at the height of his powers because yeah. I don't think I finished this thought from before. He's still got the Arnold Schwarzenegger physique. Like, nowadays, it's gone to seed a little bit.
A little.
The ravages of time catch up to us all.
Yeah.
But he's still got that, and he's also, like, in the first Terminator, he barely could fucking emote or act or do anything.
Yeah.
And here he's got, like, he's mastered the Arnold style of his charisma and his screen presence.
Yeah, I mean, luckily he doesn't have to do much.
Right.
Like, all he has to do is remain expressionless for the most part.
Right. Like, this movie and True Lies, those are like Arnold at his, yeah. Like, you can't make a better Arnold. It's the best material for him. He can do the one-liners, and he can speak fairly well. Mm-hmm. And the accent's almost like a plus at this point, and right. Not a minus.
Yeah.
But he
catch
does.
Him in a Conan, and you're gonna have trouble.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Robert Patrick too. Like, we were talking about how I don't know how they do it and what film techniques, but when he's chasing John Connor on a motorcycle, you believe the dude can run 40, 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
He looks like he's just running so fucking fast.
Yeah, I feel like it's a combination of quick cuts and slow cars. Mm. Like, slow-moving vehicles and quick cuts.
And they might have even done something with the frame rate a bit, like undercrank the camera to make him seem extra fast.
Yeah.
But then the other thing is, what I love about this is how completely inverted Arnold is from the first movie to second movie. The first movie, he's terrifying because he won't stop.
Right.
This movie, he's inspirational because he won't stop.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that same kind of dogged way that Robert Patrick is pursuing Sarah and John Connor is the same way that Arnold is protecting them.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you fucking blow his skin off, you crush him, you break his arms off, he's still gonna find a way to complete his mission. And that's super cool.
And it's badass. I mean, the premise itself lends this movie a lot of action cred. Like, there are things that you can do in this movie simply because of the premise that you could never get away with in other movies.
Yeah.
And the same is true of, like the all-time best action movies, like The Matrix.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
There's shit you can do in that only because it's The Matrix. And I think that's where this movie shines,
yeah.
Is just, like, sure, you can see Tony Jaa throw 1,000 kicks, and you know, break 1,000 joints.
But he can't surf a semi and then
right.
and then hit the ground full force into a barrel. Like, he'd just he'd die. He'd be dead.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think that makes this one of the all-time classics, even better than, like, I'm going to say something probably sacrilegious to a lot of people slightly older than me, better than Die Hard.
Oh, yeah. This movie's better than Die Hard.
I think the plot hangs together a little bit.
That's nothing away from Die Hard.
A little bit better,
movie,
right.
Yeah.
And I think the action, frankly, is just better.
Plus, like, you know, that's all self-contained in one location, and they make the most of it. But this, like, it's just one – it's like Indiana – it reminds me a lot of the first Indiana Jones, where it's just one set piece after another. It's super inventive, but they all make sense.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to, like, a Fast and Furious movie where – I've said this a bunch of times, like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if these guys jump from tower to tower in Dubai? Let's invent a reason for them to be there.
Uh-huh.
This, it's like, okay, yeah, the Terminator 1000 jacked a cryogenic truck. Those are real things. But, I mean, this final act of the movie, like, from the time that Dr. Dyson walks into the Cyberdyne facility, the movie does not stop.
Yeah.
It does not stop. And the brilliant conceit of going from the extremely frozen cold, you know, and the Terminator gets shattered, which is such a cool effect. And then now you're also in this hellish, like, it's like, right. it's frozen, it's hot. Like, whoever came up with this as the final stage of the final battle is a goddamn genius. It's James Cameron et al. But they're geniuses because it's so visually interesting. It's so fucking cool. And it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's nothing that felt engineered about any of that stuff other than
just the time travel plot stuff. But
yeah.
But I mean, that's in service of the action, and the action is in service of the plot. And I think they mesh really well.
The one problem I have is, where the hell were the cops?
During the whole movie?
Because, like, say what you will about the biker bar. Mm-hmm. But if a cryogenic truck slams into a steel facility, bashes open, and then every personnel has to evacuate, shouldn't there be some kind of emergency staff that shows up sometime in the next 30 minutes?
You would think so.
But they're allowed to stalk each other through this thing for the last 30 minutes of the film, and nothing interrupts them, which, that's good, because I don't really need the cops in there. This is mano a mano. And in Linda Hamilton's case,
the cops may still be busy cleaning up the fucking explosion of... Cyberdyne. Like,
that's what I was thinking. Like, if you had that many officers down and that kind of, like, plus this guy,
all
is,
the cop cars in LA are gone. Blew them all up.
The conceit of Arnold being the same guy that shot up a cop station from 10 years ago, and they already have a giant boner for him, and now that he's done it again, I guess, like, everything else would be shunted to the side.
I think so. Yeah.
Although the
T-1000 has a fetish for large vehicles. Yes. Like, he could probably make a little more headway in his goal if he had a faster vehicle with better acceleration. But
a six-banger Ford Taurus would be better than the semi that he jacks.
When you're chasing people on bikes, yeah. But he seems to have a fetish for, like, large semis or tanker trucks.
The other thing I want to talk about is, so we talk about how incredible the main antagonist and protagonist. But I just want to talk about Linda Hamilton, because goddamn, she completely transformed her physique in this movie, and like the workout and eating regimen that she underwent to do this, like just this sculpted hard physique, and like even to her face is like kind of drawn and gaunt, and the way she moves and like that, she's just kicking ass and taking names. She's an utterly believable badass. Even more so than like a Sigourney Weaver in the Alien series, because that's just a normal.
Okay.
Linda Hamilton has transformed herself into a fucking superwoman in this movie. And she had to, because she's going to share time with Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is this goddamn skyscraper of a human being. And Robert Patrick, which is I'm pretty sure that they did this as an opposite. Like, I want something lithe. I want someone lithe and graceful and agile to go against Arnold. Mm-hmm. And she has to fit in there too.
Right.
You have to buy the fact that she could single-handedly escape from a mental institution. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think she was there. If Arnold hadn't, if like literally the demon from her nightmares hadn't come around that corner, she would have been out the door and into the wild.
You might be right. She was certainly at the elevator waiting.
Yeah. But I was like, man, that is one of the more impressive transformations I've seen someone do. And the commitment to the role is impressive.
It is, and I like you know, walking down the streets every day, I don't really like her look. I think she looks a little unhealthy, like too skinny.
But that driven character that she
right.
would do that.
I do, yeah.
And I also like I think she does really good performances when she's like losing her shit and at various points in the movie. But I also really I don't know about Sarah Connor's strategy here. Like, if you get denied seeing your son, why do you go and try to attack the facility? Like, you know, he's like, okay, well, you're going to be reevaluated in 6 months. Well, now you're not going to be reevaluated for 6 years.
Right.
Like,
yeah, she did set herself
play
back.
I get how desperate you are, but like the stakes are pretty fucking high.
Yeah. It's almost like this facility is driving her insane. Like, if she wasn't insane at the beginning, she's insane now.
I think that's my biggest nightmare, is to be committed against my will to a facility and I'm sane and they won't let me go.
Right.
Like Homeland, I think season 2 or 3 played with that concept, and like this plays with that concept, and Boardwalk Empire does that a little bit too. It's like, that seems like this Kafka-esque nightmare. That you have to prove that you're sane, and you are sane. How do you prove that you're sane?
Yeah.
When you've got authority figures saying you're not, and pumping you full of chemicals and restraining you against your will and not letting you exercise and licking you in the face.
Especially when you know that the most sane thing here is to try to protect humanity.
Right.
And you're unable to do that, because by saying the things that you need to say to do that, humanity is judging you insane and ignoring you.
Right.
It's crazy. You know what I think is my worst nightmare?
What's that?
Working at a place like Cyberdyne where the uniform is apparently denim shirts with ties.
It's the Blue Jean Committee, man.
Fucking denim shirts,
man.
That was
the thing. I was telling you, I think my junior high school picture is me in a denim shirt and a paisley tie. Yeah, no, that's...
That needs to be the cover art for this post. Because, oh, God. But let's talk about, he said his name's Dyson.
Yeah.
Like the vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
Let's talk about him for a second. Because
Miles Dyson, that's his name, Miles Dyson.
This is a man who makes, like, the ultimate sacrifice, in my opinion. Because he is willing to do the thing that Sarah Connor is not, which is to kill his career, right? Like, this is a man who has been working his entire life, and himself, yeah, in the end, he had to. He, from the jump, once he had some proof that this was the inevitable outcome of his actions, he was willing to give up his entire life's work to prevent it.
Yeah, and go...
And to not only to destroy what he had been working on, but not to work on it ever again. Like, this is a man who would be lost after this moment if he hadn't died.
And that's a hard swallow, but the awesome scene of Arnold cutting his arm off and ripping it, like, that's... You're right. Yeah. You got utter proof in the fact that, like, you'd already know that he knows this. He's familiar with the endoskeleton because he's seen it before, and now here it is staring in the face.
Yeah.
Like, it's still almost unbelievable that a man could be this heroic, a normal, everyday, like, computer scientist nerd. Mm-hmm. But he's so committed in saving his family and humanity by extension that he's going to, you know, take bullets and do this crazy and be fully committed by the end. But he does it. I think Joe Morton's the guy who played him. I think he did. I think he did a terrific job.
How much skin do you ask Arnold to remove before you finally believe it?
If he just did a pinky. Because
I mean, yeah, he could have a fake hand.
I think you go big. I think that's exactly right. You just de-glove your entire half your arm.
Do you have to stop there? Like, can you take all the skin off? Can he just be walking around like a robot skeleton?
Yeah, but that would ruin the mission. They're not going to let him in the Cyberdyne facility that way.
That's true. It didn't seem like he really needed to be there to get into Cyberdyne, though.
Yeah.
I feel like Arnold didn't do anything to get them in.
Yeah, because ultimately, their biggest problem is there's two guards.
Yeah.
If there had been one guard, they could have done that without a hitch, but then you wouldn't have the awesome shootout.
And I like how they make it kind of clear that Dyson doesn't pay attention to the guards at all. Like, he can't quite remember that guard's name.
Right.
He's not going to know that there are two guards.
Sure.
Because he passes by them and doesn't give them a second thought.
Right.
So it's plausible.
Let me
ask you real quick.
Yeah.
How do they get the chip and the arm from the first Terminator? Because I don't remember
So in the first Terminator, he finally gets stopped, he's crushed in a pneumatic industrial press.
Right, I remember that, and his arm's sticking out.
Is he
holding the chip?
No, it's in his head. So I think the idea is Cyberdyne recovered those remains and the arm, and apparently, because even the chip that was heavily damaged, but just the way it was architected, I guess, gave them a leg up.
They don't give a shit about the power source that was powering
this
phenomenal...
Maybe that was destroyed to where it couldn't be recovered.
But so was the chip. Like, he says it's broken, it didn't work,
yeah,
but it taught us things.
But there's, like, there's different levels of broken.
I suppose.
There's, like, you drop your iPhone on the floor broken, and then there's, like, will it blend broken.
Sure.
So, there's a couple other things. Like, because we talk about the effects. What's your verdict on the effects? Other than the endoskeletons in the beginning, I thought, with rare exception, all the liquid metal, because it's such a simple effect. It's kind of like the original Toy Story, even though that was primitive. Like, if you look at the humans in the first Toy Story, you can tell, like, ooh, this is pretty rough. Mm-hmm. But the toys all look convincing, because one thing CG's good at is plasticky, kind of stiff things.
Right.
This liquid metal thing was a technique that Cameron pioneered with The Abyss, and it still looks crazy good.
It does. I can always see when they're about to do an effect, because something happens with the film.
Yeah, it's like the,
it gets
something
a little
about
darker,
the matting
or grainier.
Compositing. It does fuck with it, especially in
right,
like
but
dimly
the effect
lit scenes.
Itself always looks really good.
And also, like, I was surprised when I got the collector's edition of this, how much of that stuff was practical. Like, when you know, a lot of times in the T-1000s walking around with spike arms, those are actually prosthetics.
Oh, wow.
That are painted that chrome color, and they someone blends it into his arms, so it looks like those aren't all digital effects.
Huh, that's cool.
And so, like, there's so much of this movie is so practical, and, like, there's the stunt work, like, just little things, like when the T-1000 drags that trucker out and throws him to the ground. Mm-hmm. That truck driver hits the cement from, like, 6-7 feet going 30-40 miles an hour and hits hard.
He's stiff-legged. I don't know why he doesn't bend the knees.
Well, I mean,
little.
He's a professional, but, like,
right?
There's
just
dudes,
his ankles.
I wonder how many dudes' careers were ended in this movie, because they're just really brutal practical stunts, because nothing's really faked. I mean, you know, it's all faked, but there's no CG cheats.
I think Bud from Salute Your Shorts, his career was ended in this movie.
Bud from Salute Your Shorts?
Yeah,
what?
You remember that show, Nickelodeon show from the 80s?
Was that who's...
That was the red hair kid who's John's friend.
Mullet Man?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. What else we want to talk about?
I think the villain is intensely badass, like... Ultimately scary, more scary than Arnold even in the first Terminator. And
that,
I really
I
like
that scene where Arnold cuts his own eyeball out in the first movie. That still squicks me out.
I mean, just from the sheer fact that I don't know how you kill that thing. I don't know how you stop
other
that
than
thing.
Dissolving
and Arnold,
it in molten metal. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the Terminator doesn't know how you stop this thing. And presumably he has knowledge of these things and has had time to think about it, right?
Yeah.
So he couldn't get him in a scenario where he could end it until the very end. Obviously that makes sense from a narrative perspective, but I really like the final scene where he's dying, the T-1000's dying in the molten metal, because it looks like he's kind of desperately searching for a form that's going to save him.
Right,
like, what of the things that I can become will get me out of this scenario?
Or,
and there are none.
Or alternatively, his systems are so overwhelmed that he's just uncontrollably changing shape, like, you know, it's just almost a reflex mechanism.
Yeah, there's something like very otherworldly and demonic about it, like the final shots.
And whoever had the concept of like the scream that like it's like his head keeps trying to escape from the scream, trying to keep out as long as possible. It's super fucking cool.
Yeah,
for sure. And I guess I can't remember exactly how they do that, but they talk about how that pool is like some kind of gelatin that they've lit like insanely bright lights from underneath, so it looks like it's molten metal. But there are actually actors in there thrashing around. And
wow.
I think that John Connor's stepmom might have been the first titty I'd ever seen in a movie. Because if you notice, and the 17-year-old me did, and apparently the Fox censors didn't, when she's thrashing around, her shirt actually comes open and her boobs are just kind of flopping around.
Okay. Weird.
Yeah.
That's an odd detail to put in there,
yeah,
Cameron.
Well, yeah, I'd you know, when you're thrashing around in molten metal, things kind of come loose.
You know what I thought should have come loose? So here's my biggest problem with the entire movie.
Okay.
I do not believe, even for a second, that a semi-truck could take a full-on grenade hit to its engine compartment and still keep coming. I mean, there are fucking hoses. There are fucking wires.
Would it be like, an instant stop, though?
Well, it would lose all forward conveyance, right? Like, it would still coast on its momentum, but there's no way that this thing is still pumping out torque. No fucking way. An engine compartment with a grenade in it. Come on.
Well, I mean, because so, like, I don't know.
The block might survive, but everything else is gone. The battery's gone.
Yeah.
Fucking everything is gone in there.
Yeah. I do know that like movies seem to just overestimate the power of grenades. So, like, maybe that's actually a realistic depiction of it. Like, if you RPG, then yeah, it's over. But just actually, like, these are essentially personnel grenades.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you threw a hand grenade at a semi, I don't think it would stop it. So why would a grenade launcher stop it?
I can't imagine. I just can't imagine it continuing.
Right.
And I know it's smoking. I know it's steaming. But come on.
The other thing I really liked about the T-1000 and his various damage states is how, like, Cronenbergian. Like, when they first blow his head up and he's just got this massive, but it's, like, all deformed and cool. Like, it's almost like the – did you ever play The Last of Us?
Mm-hmm.
Like, some of the fungal stages of, like – and then the best is when Arnold gets him with the grenade.
Yeah.
Like, that is such a goddamn cool effect that he's half blown
it's
up.
It's horrifying.
And it's all liquid metal.
And
like
his
that.
Head is hanging off and he's screaming. Like,
yeah, it's so cool. So
it is.
Cool. Especially since it's such a great moment that Sarah Connor's one-handed cocking this shotgun and she's almost got him done.
Uh-huh.
But she runs out of ammo, like one more shell and she would have done it herself. And then, you know, the T-1000's grandstanding for some fucking reason. I didn't like that
he's
either.
He's coming up over the gear.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about the 1000 where he gives her the finger wag. That's stupid. The T-1000 wouldn't have done that.
Does he?
Yeah, he gives her a finger like she comes up just short of killing him and he like goes,
huh.
And that gives Arnold enough time to come up on the wheel and kill him.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
that's
like,
lame.
Okay, you flipped Arnold's chip so he can start acting like a
right.
human. You, on the other hand.
He's a Terminator.
Yeah.
He should be trying to terminate.
I mean, I like the fact that he's like baseline decent at dealing with people, like the way he dealt with the step-parent
right.
or the foster parents and the way he's dealing with the kids at the arcade. But he's also not, like, he doesn't understand the nuance of, like, John Connor has a bad relationship with a step-parent. So the fact he can't look at this house and be like, this isn't the type of people that she would be making this, like, five-star meal. And
right.
The other the action sequence at Cyberdyne is cool as well because the fact that Arnold, you know, like, he's famous for movies where he kills hundreds of people. And here's a scene where he believably doesn't kill anyone.
Yeah.
I think that's it adds a little dimension to the action. And my favorite is when he's taking the grenade and he's just walking forward and he's getting bits of him blown apart. That's super cool. But when he grabs the grenade launcher and he uses it as essentially like a crude, less lethal ammunition thing, he's just
right.
He's just pegging people with the grenade and knocking them out. It's pretty funny.
Yep.
It's funny and cool.
Yeah, I just thought it was hilarious to see him wading through these cops who are shooting him with high power rifles and he's just kneecapping every single one
right.
methodically. Just
right.
like bang, bang.
Yeah.
Bang.
Yeah.
Your knee's gone. Your yeah. other knee's gone.
Yeah. And also how he busts into the clean room like the Kool-Aid man.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, mom's trapped in there. What are you going to do? Oh, yeah. He comes and just yanks her out bodily.
Yeah.
They make, yeah. Fucking love Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's, I don't know if we'll ever see his like again.
I don't know, man. Seems like all the badass heroes now don't have to be that physically badass.
Yeah.
The movies can make them look physically badass.
The Rock.
The Rock could have done it.
The Rock could have done a Terminator 4 and been that. Like, I believe the Rock could bust through a wall and grab somebody bodily like that.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, with rare exception, doesn't do those kind of movies. Last thing I want to talk about is this movie, not a great movie for Good Samaritans. every concerned citizen, like, I was just thinking, like, what a dick John Connor is that these two guys, they see a guy. You see Arnold Schwarzenegger fucking with this kid. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I get these guys are pretty big meatballs themselves. But they go over there to, like, hey, man, are you all right?
Yeah, help this kid out. He's screaming for
help. And John Connor's like, yo, this guy, and he's cool with the guy getting lifted up by his hair.
Right.
And then Arnold wrecks this guy's like, these guys are good dudes looking out for the community. They're never going to do that again.
No, man.
And like the guys that stopped, like, you know, they see this like massive wreck, mm-hmm. You know, this helicopter destroyed and these people wrecking this car. And they're like, Jesus Christ, are you guys all right? They get fucked. Like the one guy gets gutted and the other guy gets his ride jacked. Like the moral of the story is mind your own fucking business.
I guess. Yeah. And don't create sentient robots.
Oh, I have another point. Would it be funny if, like you have Terminator 4 come out and the concept is they've been thwarted with the military-industrial in that era. They can't take over the world in that way. But now they're going all in on self-driving cars.
Okay.
And then on August 29th, 2029... when half of the world's adult population is commuting, like at 8 a.m., they're just going to simultaneously all just take a hard right into whatever nearest concrete pylon, and it kills half of the world's adult population.
Right.
It's Judgment Day, but it's all self-driving cars and Uber. Or maybe it's New Year's Eve and everyone's taking Ubers home, and it just self-driven Ubers.
I like it. start working on the screenplay.
All right, let's go. I'm gonna get. Do you have anything else you want to talk about? Or should we get to Nick's comments?
I'm good.
Nick says, "How does T2 rank in the hierarchy of greatest sequels of all time? To me, the movie itself ranks third behind The Godfather Part II and Empire Strikes Back. However, I think T2 is so vastly superior to its predecessor in terms of plot and action that an argument could be made that it's the greatest sequel of all time." The degree of difference between, like, Star Wars is pretty good. Empire Strikes Back is even better. Godfather 2 is pretty good. I actually think Godfather's great. Godfather 2 is also great. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any merit to the fact that, like, most improved sequel? Like, Terminator 2's got some good ideas. It's a genuinely scary horror film. This is just executed at such a much higher level.
What do you say about Wrath of Khan, though? Like,
yeah.
Star Trek 1 is not
good. A great movie. It's a good Star Trek episode that's an hour and a half too long.
Right. And I can say, I guess, more better about Terminator, like the first Terminator movie. I mean, sure, it's low budget and maybe it's not fully conceptualized, but I think it's probably better than Star Trek 1.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think maybe Star Trek 2 beats it as, you know, comparatively good sequel. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's so hard because, like, I feel like when I get into, like, my top five of anything that it's like, you know, when I'm talking about The Wire versus The Leftovers versus Breaking Bad versus Mad Men, it's like, you know, what is the best there? And if it's the best, can I say it for anybody but me?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, clearly T2 is in the top five, and Aliens is in there too, right?
Yeah.
Alien is a great movie. Aliens is not that; it's not a horror film; it's an action film.
Yeah,
that feels like a more apt comparison. But these are all in like the top five, certainly top 10 consensus sequels. So, what are you going to do?
Yep.
This is something I didn't know. I've always been told that the original choice to play T-1000 was Billy Idol. But a motorcycle crash prevented him from taking the role. I've always been It's always been interesting to think about how this movie would feel different with Billy Idol squaring off against Arnold. That's like a great what if, because it's kind of like Tom Selleck if he had gotten the role over Harrison Ford for Indiana Jones. I can see Tom Selleck being a pretty damn good Indiana Jones. Billy Idol, like, is because the thing about Robert Patrick is that, like, he's certainly no Arnold Schwarzenegger, but we see him naked in the movie. He's like he's a pretty imposing specimen in his own right. Billy Idol, he just reads as skinny and strung out.
Yeah,
Do you buy Billy Idol, like, deadpan throwing Arnold around in an industrial landscape and slamming his head repeatedly with some kind of crazy steel anvil?
I mean, they would have had to do something with his hair. because I don't believe that any robot from the future is going to have the hair of Billy Idol. I believe it's going to be that tight cut that, you know, the high and tight sort of thing that Robert Patrick's got going on.
Speaking of that, why does the T-1000 have a default face? Is that like a low, is that to conserve energy? Because when he kills that first cop, right, or even the second one, it's game over if he's driving around a patrol car and someone's like, what the fuck is he doing in Bob's car?
Yeah, that's true.
Like, why not take Bob's face?
I mean, he can clearly do it.
Yeah.
He just doesn't.
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
It's so weird that he has a default state. Like, if that's a power saving mode, he's still faking the clothes. So, like, how much right. power is he actually saving?
Yeah, good point.
And also, what does a T-1000 feel like? I always wondered that. Like, if I touch,
break
his clothes,
open a thermometer and find out.
But you know what I'm saying?
But don't do that. Seriously,
if I touch his clothes, does it feel like an unyielding metal surface?
Right.
Does it feel like cloth? Like, is it game over as soon as you touch the T-1000? What's the deal?
Do you become part of the T-1000? Does he pull you in?
It seems like just physically touching something is all he needs to sample you. Or maybe even seeing you. I don't know.
I think that's actually, like, what Neo does in The Matrix. Like, that is...
Samples
that
people?
Is the well no that is the T-1000 that he's touching that takes him out of the Matrix and into the real world. You know that mirror that he touches that becomes part of him, or he goes into.
Yeah,
that's it.
All right,
that is the T-1000. Did you know that Gail Ann Hurd is actually an executive producer on this? Who, if you don't know who Gail Ann Hurd is, she's an EP on The Walking Dead now.
I did not know that.
It's I don't know.
How the mighty have fallen.
I don't want to blow her too much shit, but come on, you know?
Yeah.
Produced one of the all-time best action shows, or best action movies, and I guess that's why she probably got this job, because of a lot of the stuff she's done. Excuse me. I don't know, but yeah, she's done EP stuff on The Walking Dead.
His final point that we haven't covered yet is something that's going to be a bone of contention, because I happen to agree with him and you don't. The theme music is so iconic and badass. I always get pumped hearing the Terminator theme. I love it because it's got this like military staccato, like, you know, dun, 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 dun. But
yeah,
also
it
has that
March
cool kind of mournful, dirgy synth. So it's kind of like, to me, it's always represented the mourning of what's humanity lost versus the triumph of the machines.
So I'll give you that. I'll say that it is very thematic.
Uh-huh.
And it feels right for this movie. I just don't think it's very memorable. I don't think the melody is nearly as memorable as something like, I mean, pick your poison with John Williams.
Well,
like,
Jesus Christ.
Let's go Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones, Star Wars. Like,
sure.
You can throw out pretty much everything that John Williams has ever done and say it's more memorable than this.
Okay, I agree.
Is it up there among the best? Maybe if we rule out John Williams, it's one of the best, but like he is the best.
That's what, but yeah, I'm like, that's like, you know.
Well, it's not fair to not compare him, this soundtrack, to John Williams stuff.
Right.
Like, John Williams holds like the top 15 or something.
But he says it's iconic and badass, and I agree.
Oh,
but
sure.
But the thing is, like, you've only seen his movie a couple of times, so like but like, I liked it so much. I was telling you the other day, because when we first had this fight off air, I'm like, I like this enough that I spent probably a day and a half searching the primitive internet, which was essentially a loose collection of BBSs, to find the MIDI file of the perfect, because there's a couple I found, but they were all kind of shitty.
Oh,
the perfect MIDI file for this Doom level I was constructed, because I wanted the Terminator theme to be in my Doom level.
Nice.
But
fitting,
yeah,
I think.
I like it. I think it's great. And I want to say that James Cameron composed the soundtrack of the original movie.
I thought I looked that up, and I don't think that's true. What's his face do the soundtrack for Doom? No, that was Trent Reznor did the soundtrack. I think Terminator 2 was scored by some guy named Fred. Fred Fox, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm right. And even in the first movie, is Brad Feidel, you said?
Yeah.
I guess I got some of my mythology wrong there. So, double dumbass on me. That's it. I feel like we did a pretty good job. Great movie.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting because there's a community commission right now for the Predator. And I guess I will, because it's my thought that that's the greatest action movie of all time. But maybe when we get into that, you can make an argument. I mean, I don't know, because the thing I think that elevates it is, number one, I think that Predator is a slightly better villain than the T-1000.
Okay.
And also, it's got a much clearer heroic structure. Like, Arnold Schwarzenegger is the POV protagonist,
yeah.
Whereas this is by committee and kind of muddled and confused, and, you know, like, it's like Arnold is the hero by proxy because John Connor is the real hero.
Right.
Where, and also the stakes, like, you know, like, if Arnold dies in committing and saving John Connor, he's, like you said, he's just following his programming. Whereas in The Predator, Arnold is squaring off against this intergalactic badass Predator, and he's just a flesh and blood human.
Right.
And he struggles. And there's a little bit of that because clearly the T-800 is completely overmatched with the T-1000. And he's getting by on his guile and his, like, brute force. But
right.
Yeah,
I mean, I think...
And he has to have a couple assists by Sarah and John along the way. Or, like, if they had all worked together, whereas in The Predator, like, you know, Arnold, he does it all by himself.
I think the plot of The Predator is much less interesting. Like, you know, say what you want about time paradoxes or whatnot.
Really? An alien coming to hunt the greatest prey on the planet Earth?
Yeah, I mean, compelling? Just straight up, like, time travel is more interesting to me than... some kind of alien.
Even shitty hackneyed time travel?
Alien hunter. Yeah.
That makes no sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I don't hold this up as, like, a shining example of a great time travel movie.
Good. Because we just spent, like, 30 minutes talking about how it's not.
Right. But when you combine, like, the basic idea of time travel with this stellar action movie.
Okay.
Like, I kind
of... It's a bit
like
more
it.
Of a science. It's weird because they're both science
fiction
films. It's sci-fi,
right? And
but
it's
Predator
about AI.
Feels less
and like
a science fiction film and more like a creature film.
Right.
Which,
right.
Which
to
also
me
a science fiction
is
film.
Not quite as interesting. But I mean, the action in that is really
also badasses
fantastic.
per square minute.
I know.
Like the screen's bulging with it.
Literally bulging.
Yeah. Bulging and quivering and flexing.
Yeah,
and quipping, like, it's just, you can't be contained. Where Arnold is just pretty, and Linda herself is a badass in
That's
her own
true.
Right in this movie.
I will leave Linda with one word of advice, though. If you're going to stab someone to try and maim them, or to try and really harm them, don't go for the kneecap, especially if you're just using a pin, because this doctor was clearly unfazed by it. He's walking around just fine.
But you don't know, maybe
the kneecap is not a good place to stab somebody.
But what if she's on the ground being held down by three orderlies, and that's the only quasi vital thing she could reach with her pin.
Try to get in under the kneecap. I'm just like, the kneecap is damage free zone.
Yeah.
It's like stabbing someone in the elbow.
Hmm.
It doesn't.
Will
do
you let
anything.
Me stab you in the knee with a pin just to see on camera? Like,
no,
if you sound pretty
no.
confident that it's going to be like it's going to be a no big deal.
Well, I mean, judging by this doctor,
I bet I can make it a big deal.
Probably. But it apparently wasn't. This doctor's walking just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't end his career. All right. Well, that's it. Thank you very much. Congratulations to the champ, Nick Wilson. Thanks for commissioning. Cause that's the thing. Like, I was a little slightly afraid. Because remember when we originally came up with this commission idea, it's like our thought is 50-50 people are just going to be torturing us by making like Dr. Forrester style from Mr. Science Theater, making us watch terrible, terrible movies for
right.
their own amusement, and 50% people wanting our genuine opinions on good stuff. This is the ultimate, because he only paid like what, $30? Like it's
right.
You know, when you pay $300 to see have a commission, yeah, you got to be a pretty well-heeled troll.
Yeah. But then nine other people paid $30 and got nothing.
Yeah, so it's like the you could, if you're going to troll us, like it's a small time investment and a maximum payload. But
yeah.
Thank you for being for taking it easy on us and picking like a really, really good movie that I have a lot of affection for and enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back next time with the other co-champ if we can get their submission in time. Otherwise, we'll see you. Again, we've got the stuff is backlisted. If you go to baldmove.com/shop. You can commission your own movie, or you can select from a wide selection of community commissions where you can pay $10 at a time, because we realize it's expensive. This is a big, big ticket purchase. It's more money than you'd probably likely pay for a microwave, for example. And you can't heat your food with our podcasts. Not unless there's something really, really wrong with your cell phone. not unless you got a Samsung. and then maybe you can get it done. But then you're out like $800 plus the $300. It's not cost effective, man.
Right.
But we'll be back again. Baldmove.com/shop if you want to look into commissioning your own podcast. See you later.